We're on page 2, Roman numeral 3, A Walk Through the Life of Joseph. We spent our first hour in establishing the purpose of God taking the nation down into Egypt for some 400 years, and then we called out 5 of the major lessons that come out of Genesis 37 through 50, the events of 37 through 50. And now we want to go straight through in an orderly way and look at some of these things in the life of Joseph. There is a change in the way I've outlined this, and I think I'll probably follow through with it, again, still experimenting, is notice this goes from 37, an outline, starting with A, clear through to the end of the book, and therefore kind of gives you captions for what the content of the rest of the book is. That does not mean that I will necessarily comment on each one of these things. We'll let that relate to the time. But under each one of those things, we've simply left space for several comments that we want to make that I hope are important on the events within it. And we're ready to look at the first section of the life of Joseph. Chapter 37 begins with him up in Canaan with the sheep and his brothers, and it ends up down in Egypt. So that gives us a good first breaking point. Joseph from Canaan to Egypt. And I'll let you use your judgment on what you think is worthwhile as far as things to put down under it. Sometimes I'll say there are 4 things to be sure to note, and sometimes we'll not do that. I'll let you select them. On the first one here, we want to note, first of all, the hatred of the brothers. Beginning in verse 1, Jacob lived in the land where his father had sojourned, in the land of Canaan. Now these are the records of the generations, or this is the history of. Remember, we've got this 10 times in the book of Genesis, the little expression, these are the records of the generations. Hebrew word toledoth, which simply means a history of. This is the history of Jacob. Joseph, when 17 years of age, was pasturing the flock with his brothers while he was still a youth, along with the sons of Bilhah, Dan and Naphtali, and the sons of Zilpah, Gad and Asher. I'm able to put those in because I went back and reviewed and remembered what we did last week. Remember coming down the 12 sons? And I'm sure had I said the sons of Bilhah and paused, I would have gotten the response, choral response, Dan and Naphtali, right? Okay, I didn't do that in the interest of time. Now Israel loved Joseph more than all his sons, and he was the son of his old age. And he made him a very colored tunic. And his brothers saw that his father loved him more than all his brothers, and so they hated him and could not speak to him on friendly terms. So you have very clearly a seedbed of hatred on the part of the brothers. Now when you have that hatred, the hatred on the part of the brothers basically flowed from 2 things. The hatred flowed from, number 1, what we have back in verse 2, this bad report. Now, you might think in verse 2, what is it when Joseph gives this bad report on the part of his brothers, or bad report about his brothers, and takes it to his father, what do you think? How does that strike you? How does that hit you? I think we need to clear that up. Does it hit you as, nyeh, nyeh, nyeh? Little brothers telling on the rest of his brothers. I don't think we've really got that flavor at all from the general tone of Joseph. It could very well be, and in fact I think the context will support it, is that he was responsible to make a report on what his brothers did. And I think that position of responsibility is indicated by the tunic. And notice if you've got New American, you've got it a very colored tunic. If you have King James, you have what? Coat of many colors? Okay, when we understand what this tunic was and what it represented, then I think we'll find out that in verse 2, when he took back the report about his brothers, and it was a bad one, he was not tattling. He was fulfilling his responsibility, and if there's anything that's true of Joseph, Joseph always takes responsibility seriously. He always handles it faithfully without any question. If he's in jail, he's going to be faithful to any job you give him. And if he is the prime minister of Egypt, he'll be faithful to that job. Faithfulness marks him all the way through. And I would take it in verse 3. When he brings back to his father this report, we don't know what the report was, but it wasn't a good one, about what his brothers were doing. He was simply fulfilling a responsibility. Now, the reason we can take that is coming out of this very colored tunic, which was a second reason why they hated him. There is, about 1900 B.C., an interesting tomb drawing that has been found. And the tomb drawing has a group of Semites. Semites would be your Shemitic people or Semitic people, which of course Jacob and his sons would be. And they're arriving, and the leaders have on these many-colored, many-pieced, long tunics. Now that gives us a clue then to, we'll just put down the leaders, wore many-colored, many-pieced tunics. In other words, it's very distinguishable. We don't have the means for putting it up here, but if we could put this tomb scene up here and had it on a slide, you would obviously note, well, here's a group of people, and notice the way that just a few of them are dressed differently with these many-pieced, long tunics with many colors, and they were obviously, from various other things in the picture, they were the leadership. So I take it, then that explains why he brought back a bad report. He's not tattling. He's not saying, look, I got something on my brothers, I'm going to run and tell Dad, and I'm going to tattle. That's not the tone. Jacob had apparently made him a leader over his brothers and given him a special position, and therefore he was responsible to bring back a report. So verse 3 is responsible administration. It is not tattletale. Now, following in the context, and while he was faithful, it's very possible that in the next thing he does, he might not have been too wise. In other words, there's something about being very young that is has a lack of guile to it. It doesn't recognize some facets of human personality. You may have a 14-year-old running up and say, I'm first, I'm the best in my class. And he only knows that he worked hard and he accomplished. But for those that have been around a little while, why wouldn't you say that out loud? What do you know about humanity and people that would make you say, I'm not going to probably broadcast that too broadly? You know that men have a green streak. And probably if I announce those accomplishments, not trying to brag, but just being objective, you certainly learn with time that you don't say those things too loudly because someone is going to become jealous and so forth. Now, I take it that in the following context, this is sort of the tone of Joseph. Joseph gets a dream, he recognizes it from God, and he's all enthusiastic and goes to his brothers and says, guess what happened? We had our sheaves in the field, mine stood up, and all of yours bowed down to it. Now, if you have a little reality, I mean, at 17, you might say, boy, are the brothers going to share in my enthusiasm? And I take it that's the tone. And because of that, of course, his brothers respond in verse 8, and they say, are you actually going to reign over us? Are you really going to rule over us? So they hated him even more for his dreams and for his words. And his dreams, of course, will be prophetic fulfillment of what God is going to do with him. So notice right here in Joseph representing the Word of God, he is buying the hatred of his brothers or those that do not honor that word. Then, of course, he has a second dream, and the second dream is a little more detailed. It's one of the sun, moon, and stars. And the sun, moon, and the moon and the stars bow down to him. The expansion is when he takes it home and tells his father and his brothers, which increase the hatred again on part of his brothers, or jealousy on part of the brothers, that Jacob says, do you mean your brothers and your mother and are going to bow down to you? Which would indicate that the moon represented the mother and the stars represented the brothers. And the interesting thing is, coming down in the latter part, in verse 11, his brothers were jealous, this is jealous hatred, but his father kept them in his, kept the saying in mind. So notice his response is just kind of tuck it away. This might be prophetic of something, which it definitely was. Now, with this, we get in the 37th chapter the first example of two things. In chapter 37, we get the first example of two things. Number one, we get the first example of a righteous man suffering innocently. And one thing we want to begin to stress in our study through the Old Testament, in all of our studies, is to try to get some good, solid application out of this and be able to get down and say, okay, look, Joseph did what was right. He honored God. He was faithful in his job. Am I? Can I parallel this man in any way? His brothers hated him because he represented the Word of God. Have you ever run onto that type of situation this week? He is going to suffer innocently. Are you in that kind of situation? Well, if you're in that kind of situation, then here's where you ought to begin to say, look, I want to respond in a Joseph-like way because the Lord was with him and the Lord blessed him. I want his attitude. Here's a man that will keep the entire known world from starvation, and he was started out by being terribly mistreated in his youth. Or, here's a man, and notice we had the note in verse 3, that he was 17. Are you 17? Or in a young category? Are there going to be some temptations and things that we're going to see in going through the life that you're going to be able to identify with? Try to do that. That's the importance of application of the Word and how we get it to operating and working as far as our life is concerned. Now, here comes the first example of the innocent suffering. And notice, this would be pretty traumatic. We're going to have something on the part of what do the majority of his brothers want to do to him. We're going to have a comment on the part of Reuben on what Reuben wants to do to him. And then we're going to have another brother, Judah. And Judah is going to comment on what we should do with him. So notice the pressure now that's going to be put on him. 37:20. Now then, come and let us kill him. That's the majority saying, let's kill Joseph. That's strange at 17, isn't it? I mean, he's got every right in the world when he's 24 years old to really be messed up. And hey, you would too if you had that happen to you when you were little. So let's not go hard on him. No, not Joseph. Joseph never asked for sympathy, not whatsoever. He takes all of this pressure and he handles it very well. As a matter of fact, he's able to pull all these brothers together because of mental attitude. So let's kill. Then you come down to the remark on the part of Reuben. And Reuben eases up a little bit. Instead of killing him and shedding blood, let's throw him in a pit and he'll starve to death. That's kinder. Reuben said, verse 22 now, Reuben further said to him, shed no blood, throw him into the pit. Okay. Don't kill, throw into a pit. The pit would have probably looked something like that, a water pit. Many examples of those have been found where they're dug in such a way that it's sort of like an inverted light bulb, and the water is held down in the pit. And you can see you'd have a great deal of difficulty climbing out of that pit since unless you had glue on your feet because of the bulbous nature of the thing. So the idea is let's throw him down in there. Blood won't be shed, and he obviously in the pit is going to starve to death. The pit had no water in it. There was no attempt to drown him there. Okay, along comes Judah, and he says, well, let's, yes. Okay, I was viewing it from the standpoint of, well, two standpoints. Number one, apparently, he wanted to appease the brothers who wanted to kill him. And the thought would be, from their standpoint, we'll put him in the pit and he'll starve to death. In my own mind, I'm going to come back and get him. In other words, they wanted to kill, and he's trying to find a way to pacify him. And he says, let's not take his life, but throw him in the pit, which would convey to them the idea, well, we've disposed of him. But he is going to come back himself, and when he comes back, he doesn't find him. Okay, the suggestion of Judah is, again, different in verse 27. Let's not kill him and cover up his blood, but verse 27, let's sell him. Okay, so the option turns out to sell Joseph. And again, what did Joseph do to merit being killed? He was faithful to his job. What did he do to be thrown in the pit? He didn't do anything to be thrown in the pit. He was innocent. What did he do to be sold? And all of this is degrading, terribly degrading. What did he do to be sold into Egypt? He didn't do anything except faithfulness. What do we have? We have a righteous man suffering innocently. That, incidentally, is why some, and I think there's some weight to it, some will use Joseph as an illustration of Christ, in that Joseph suffered innocently, so Christ suffered innocently. He suffered innocently, and as a result of his suffering, all of Egypt was saved from starvation. So you do see a little parallel there, at least illustratively, as far as Christ is concerned. This is also now the first example of God's sovereignty. And that comes down to verse 27. Verse 36. Meanwhile, and we may not see this at first, but it'll develop. Meanwhile, the Midianites sold him in Egypt to Potiphar, Pharaoh's officer, the captain of the bodyguard. Now, the idea is going to be, is God will put Joseph, and this is a principle all the way through, God will put Joseph in a place where his faithful character can be exhibited. God will put him in a place where his character gets observed. Now, what does that say, then, that Joseph has to concentrate on? Only one thing, his character. It's all that makes any difference. He doesn't have to maneuver himself in. He doesn't have to figure out a way to be seen. He has to be something. And therefore, the whole thing is what? Mental attitude. If I keep relating to God correctly, God moves around and puts me in the proper place, and God is simply saying, I see what you are, and I am going to use the sin of your brothers in my sovereign way, and I'm going to put you in a way where Pharaoh is going to see you. In other words, I am going to be responsible for the advancement. And can you think of anything that could happen to Joseph or anybody else that would prevent you from being in a right relationship to God? There's nothing in the world. The only person that can mess up my relationship to God is me. You say, well, someone can mistreat you. Yes, but I have the option to respond, don't I? And react in a proper way. And if I react in the right way, we can only develop. And this will be all the way through with Joseph. He's always getting put in a place where his faithful character gets observed. And every time it gets observed, zip, right to the top every time. Joseph is, I think of him sort of like taking a hollow ball in a tub of water and pulling it down to the bottom. You can pull it down, but boop, up she comes every time. That's always Joseph. All right. So we got two things then in the first section is the sovereignty of God is in action, and you also have the innocent suffering. Now, coming to Judah and Tamar, or B in the outline, we've got to ask a question about that section. The first thing we'd say about Genesis 38 is Joseph isn't in it. Why isn't he in it? Why does this incident come in? Notice beginning in verse 1 of 38, it came to pass about that time that Judah departed from his brothers and visited a certain Adullamite whose name was Hira. And Judah saw there a daughter of a captain Canaanite whose name was Shua, and he took her in and he went to her. She conceived and bore a son, and he named him Ur. She conceived again and had Onan. She had another son, called him Shelah. And then Judah took a wife of Ur, his firstborn, his name was Tamar. And in the context, the boys do something evil, and it's kind of terse and brief. Ur, Judah's firstborn, verse 7, was evil in the sight of the Lord, so the Lord took his life. That's quick, neat work. Then you have, coming into the context, the idea of levirate marriage. Levirate marriage simply meant this. If you've got, let's say, two brothers, and one brother dies, leaving a widow, the remaining brother is responsible to raise up seed for his brother. In other words, if you have the two brothers, take two wives, one brother dies, leaving a widow, then remaining brothers have a levirate responsibility to bring a seed to them. Onan refuses to do that. Verse 9, Onan knew that the offspring would not be his. And so it came about that when he went into his brother's wife, he wasted his seed, or the sperm, on the ground in order not to give offspring to his brother. Now, may I say, and I don't know if this is needful or not, because some will use this, this is not a passage forbidding birth control. And I'm not trying to be humorous. I'm saying that because some people have said that that is what is being taught in this passage. I don't think that's the idea at all. The idea is he will not raise up seed. And the importance of raising up seed is that we're dealing with the Messianic line. And consequently, refusal to father that which would be in the Messianic line. At any rate, Tamar recognizes that she has been cheated, and there is one brother remaining, but he's too young to marry. And Judah says, well, when he grows up, you can have him for a husband. He grows up and obviously is not going to be the husband of Tamar. So Tamar decides that she's been had, and so she disguises herself as a prostitute. And as Judah is traveling along, Judah sees the prostitute, propositions the prostitute, and she said, what will you give me for my services? And he promises a sheep, which he doesn't happen to have along with him. And so she says, well, what will you give me as guarantee? And so he gives him his signet ring, his staff. In other words, she has him. And at any rate, he comes back with the sheep and says, where was the prostitute? The people in the area say there was no prostitute here. In the meantime, she's put on her widow's garment again, shed the prostitute's garb, and finds out a little bit later on that Judah finds out that Tamar has deceived him. And, of course, he becomes extremely righteous and says, bring her out and let's burn her. And she doesn't worry too much about that. She just saunters out with, gentlemen, I am pregnant by the man whose signet ring I have. Whose signet ring is here? Any volunteers? And, of course, Judah becomes a little less pious. And as they examine whose ring it is, he says, she's more righteous than I, inasmuch as I did not give her my son Shelah. And then the children are born to her. The important one is down in verse 50. It says, as he was born, he drew back his hand, and his brother came out and said, what a breach you have made for me. She named him Perez. Now you say, you know, this is kind of sordid, isn't it? Why is this passage here? What's the reason for this? Having narrated, why is this incident narrated? And I can think of three good reasons. Number one, to demonstrate that the coming of Christ was the grace of God. To demonstrate the grace of God. I mean, let's face it, there is some sinning in this chapter. But remember her name, Tamar, and remember the son, Perez. Go to Matthew 1. This obviously demonstrates the grace of God. The book of the genealogy of Jesus Christ, the son of David, the son of Abraham. To Abraham was born Isaac, and to Isaac Jacob, to Jacob Judah and his brothers, and to Judah was born Perez and Zerah by Tamar. So look who's in the line of Christ. How did Tamar get in the line of Christ? How did she qualify to get in the line of Christ? By sinning. You think of anything else she did to get there? She got in the line of Christ by sinning. What qualifies us for salvation? What's our chief qualification? We're sinners. Okay, so let's not go hard on Tamar. That's the way we got there too. It is interesting that that's a beautiful demonstration, then, is it not, of the grace of God in salvation. You can't pick up Matthew chapter 1 if you were a Jew and say, boy, aren't we great? Look at the great noble families that brought about the Messiah. Can't do that. This is all a matter of grace. All right, back to the chapter. And can we see in context why Genesis chapter 38 might be placed there? Where did we last see Joseph in chapter 37? Meanwhile, the Midianites sold him in Egypt to Potiphar, Pharaoh's officer, captain of the bodyguard. Don't you wonder, at the end of chapter 37, what happens next? What happens to him down there? And what is good in literature? Where do the soaps usually end? Don't they take you right up to who? And they cut it off. Why? Good literary device to create suspense. What's happening to Joseph down there? Well, let's just let it rest for a little bit, so we'll have you ready for chapter 39. Third, it's there to create contrast. And the contrast is, look at Judah's character in chapter 38, verses 15 and 16. 38, 15 and 16, insight into Judah's character. Verse 15, when Judah saw her, he thought she was a harlot, for she had covered her face. So he turned aside to her by the road and said, here now, let me come in to you. For he did not know that this was his daughter-in-law, and she said, what will you give me that you may come into me? That's the character of Judah. What's the character of Joseph? Chapter 39. 7 and 8. It came about after these events that his master's wife looked with desire at Joseph and said, lie with me. But he refused and said to his master's wife, behold, with me around, my master does not concern himself with anything in the house, and he has put all that he owns in my charge, and so forth. But notice the contrast we got in characters. So we've got a contrast between Judah and Joseph. So I take it those are two reasons within the context why Moses, in writing the narrative, very skillfully uses the device of suspense, he uses the device of contrast between these two, and therefore it's, I'll put it this way, Genesis 38 is an interruption, it's not an intrusion. An intrusion would mean it just doesn't fit here. An interruption means, yes, we do lose Joseph, but it's there, it doesn't intrude, it just gives us a beautiful picture of the contrast between the two. All right, next, Joseph and Potiphar's wife. Chapter 39. Genesis 39. Incidentally, and I think you can probably see this, when we handed out the syllabus in the first place, we said where we'd be going each session. It would be enormous help had you read through Genesis 37 through 50 this week, or last week. I know that's an enormous order, isn't it? Read a few chapters in the Bible this week. It would be tremendously helpful because you'd have a sense of the narrative that would be important. We'll be doing next time the oppression down in Egypt. That's Exodus 1 through 11. And if in the busy schedule you have time for God's Word this week, it won't hurt you a bit to read it. Okay, 39. Now, we've already noted in our first study, notice in the first six verses the tremendous prosperity on the part of Joseph. Five times the Lord's presence is mentioned. Once in verse 2, the Lord is with Joseph. twice in verse 3, then you have it twice in verse 5. Five times you have the mention that the Lord was with him. Notice Joseph, what's he doing down in Egypt? Sold into his house, seeking sympathy, seeking pity, nothing like that. That leads us then into the temptation of Joseph. Now, let's do a little chronology here so we can get his age, perhaps. Go over to 41:46. In 41:46, we have a time fix. It says, Joseph was 30 years old when he stood before Pharaoh, king of Egypt. So that's his exaltation. So we've got him as the prime minister at age 30. From that time fixed, if you go back to 41:1, it says it happened at the end of 2 full years that Pharaoh had a dream. You've got to subtract 2 from 30, leaving you 28. Then he was 17 when he was in the field, so you subtract that, and you come out with something like this. He was in prison, apparently, age 25 through 29. He was in Potiphar's house 18 through 24, and he was sold at 17. I put down the chronology there just to... So we'll have a little idea that we're dealing with a very young person here, a tremendous stress and strain at age 17. And now, as he's in the house of Potiphar, his temptation in this chapter is going to come between ages 18 and 24, somewhere along the line. And from there, he will have his first big dose of the righteous suffering innocently, because he stands firmly for principle, he stands firmly for the Lord, and as a result of that firm stand, he goes to jail. Now, there is a way that Joseph could have avoided all of his suffering. Just stop being righteous. Just don't do that, and you can avoid all of this type thing. But that's not the kind of character that Joseph is in any sense of the word. Now, in 39, let's stress the things that he had going for him at, say, 18. Okay? The first one is in verse 3 of 39. The Lord was with Joseph, so he became a successful man, and he was in the house of his... I'm doing this wrong. Go to verse 8 first. I'm sorry, verse 8. When he is propositioned by Potiphar's wife, it says, he refused and said to his master's wife, "Behold, with me around, my master does not concern himself with anything in his own house, and he has put all the owns in my charge." First thing this 18-year-old has going for him is loyalty. 39:8. It's an amazing quality, isn't it? I have been made responsible for a job, and my employer, your husband, holds me responsible for doing the job, and I will be loyal. That's not half bad, is it? Second, in verse 9, he says, "There is no one greater in this house than I, and he has withheld nothing from me except you, because you're his wife. How then could I do this great evil," and catch this, "and sin against," and the personal pronoun him falls in so naturally, doesn't it? "Sin against him." Hey, he's got doctrinal insight. Sin is against God. And that is very simple. Sin is against God. True, I'll be loyal. But there's the heart of the issue, and that's good insight. Hey, how many 18-year-olds around today recognize, look, I have a responsibility, and if I don't fulfill that responsibility, I'm disloyal to God? How many of you see? How popular is this? And if you're 17, 18 years old, is that your viewpoint? Can you bring that down into shoe leather and say, hey, I'll buy that, I'll go that route? Sin is against God. The typical thinking is, go ahead and sin, but don't get caught. Okay, thank you, Lisa. You knew that one well. You said it. Okay. Okay, third, verse 3. The Lord was with Joseph. Very simply, he had something else going, fellowship with God. Personal relationship to God. Joseph and God were personal with one another. Verse 6. So he, Potiphar, left everything he owned in Joseph's charge. And with him around, he did not concern himself with anything except the food which he ate. That was custom, Egyptian custom, that a foreigner does not involve himself in the food. So we've got a third or fourth thing, ability to carry responsibility. Ability to carry responsibility. Last part of verse 6. Joseph was handsome in form and appearance. Appearance would be his good looks. Form would mean physically. He was built well. He was handsome. Physical attractiveness. Those are all neat things to have going for you, aren't they? Loyalty. You understand that sin is against God. You have fellowship with God. You and God are personal on personal terms. You can take responsibility. And on top of it, you're good looking. Okay, enter Satan. Where would you suggest we go to work? You're 17, 18? You got some of these qualities? Where is Satan going to make the... Where's he going to knock on the door? He's good looking, isn't he? Okay, we know how to do that. So, notice what happens. It's not an accident that the last sentence of verse 6 is butted up against verse 7. So let's read them together. Joseph was handsome in form, in body, in appearance. And it came about after these events that his master's wife looked with desire at him and said, lie with me. So notice the area of attack coming in here is from the physical standpoint. He resists. He manifests the right viewpoint. She's persistent in this day after day after day. And finally, one day, coming down to verse 11, it happened one day that he went into the house to do his work, and none of the men of the household was there inside. And she caught him by the garment, said, lie with me, and left his garment in her hand and fled and went outside. This is the acceleration from 0 to 60. This is the New Testament, flee youthful lusts. No, staying around to check it out. He moved out. He did the right thing. And hey, if you do the right thing, you're not going to suffer for it, right? No, you'll maintain the most important thing in the world, relationship to God, and he'll honor that. But she lies about him and says that, verse 17, the Hebrew slave whom you brought us came into me and made sport of me. And it happened, I raised my voice and screamed, and he left his garment beside me and fled outside. And tells her husband about it. And so Joseph's master took him and put him in jail. And there is your reward for standing for the Lord. Well, let's come down off cloud 9 that says you honor God. And God will see that everything in life will honor you justly and righteously. Not true. It's the only way to go, but here's a good example of it. So he now ends up in jail. But notice, this guy's got time to really begin to get hacked off. Hey, I got sold by my brothers, and that isn't right. Now I stood righteously where I ought to, and now I'm in jail, and I am mad. Verse 21. No tone of bitterness. What's the real only single issue? Verse 21. The Lord was with Joseph. See, fellowship never gets broken, and that's all that counts. The Lord is with Joseph, which is all Joseph has to worry about, and extended kindness to him and gave him favor in the sight of the chief jailer. Notice, you maintain horizontal relationship and God cares for vertical. We maintain vertical, God maintains the horizontal relationships. And what happens? Here he comes right up to the top again. The chief jailer, verse 22, committed to Joseph's charge all the prisoners who were in the jail, so that whatever was done there, he was responsible for it. The chief jailer did not supervise anything under Joseph's charge because the Lord was with him, and whatever he did, the Lord made to prosper. And that's all that counts in life. It's hard to see, isn't it? I don't know. Coming through Joseph's situation, I think I would have cried out for a little more justice than that. But he didn't. He will become prime minister. It's also interesting, the road to leadership is always the same. He had to go through the pits to get to a place of leadership. When the nation gets born, what are we going to have in the beginning of Exodus? We're going to have the nation in the pits, aren't we? They're going to be bent over with labor and oppression before God brings them out in redemption. That is God building the nation of Israel. That's God building a Joseph. That's God building an Abraham. That's God building a believer. Always, always, the pressure cooker is there before the leadership and the maturity can come about. All right? Notice again, closing out chapter 39, you've got three times the fact that the Lord is with Joseph. And I think we'll stop at that point and pick up with Joseph in prison on through the rest of the narrative tonight. Father, we're thankful for the narrative you put in front of us for our edification. We pray that we'll come to understand the important principles, that the really essential rock bottom issue always is how are we relating personally to you. And may we recognize that the other things are not the issue, that if we have this straightened out, that you're able to place us in the right place, you're able to cause whatever ability and whatever character has been built by you to be recognized by others. And may we recognize that public relations for our own personality is not our job, that's yours. Our responsibility is relationship to you. And therefore, we're thankful for this young man who was loyal, who understood the issues of where sin was, it was against God and God only, and that he maintained this faithfulness. And though he suffered for it, we're thankful that that suffering made him in to a man that saved the then known world through his wisdom. For this we give you thanks in Christ's name.